your day.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO. Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
A Marist College poll finds the most annoying word in a conversation is
whatever. And it's like,
at the end of the day.
So I was like, you guys talk like grown-ups.
I think you did a fantastic job laying that out. Thank you.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
We will have a public option.
Are you quite sure?
Climate Gate emails. It has everything to do with cleaning up the air. Global warming is a hoax.
What's the weather like on your planet?
I've done a lot of radio shows, but you're the best interviewer that I ever had the pleasure to speak with.
I take that as high praise.
You see, we're on a mission from God.
Let me thank you for being with me. We've got an hour to talk about the things that matter most. Radical feminist theologian, I'm reluctant to say Catholic because I don't think the word really applies, but radical feminist theologian Mary Daly passed on. And if I can get a few minutes in, I want you to take a listen to the way she interpreted some of the basic Marian dogmas. We'll also have a great article posted at AveMariaRadio.net, which does just that. But that's coming up later today. And then Kevin Appleby will also join us. He's director of the Office of Migration and Refugee Policy at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. The bishops are asking us to engage in a postcard campaign calling upon Congress to come up with new immigration policy in 2010. Bishop John Wester of Salt Lake City, Utah, chairman of the USCCB Committee on Migration, said it is our view and that of others that the American public, including the Catholic and other faith communities, want a humane and comprehensive solution to the problems which beset our immigration system, and they want Congress to address this issue. Kevin Appleby joining us to discuss the bishop's effort. Also today, one of the best known, most respected, renowned moral theologians in the English-speaking world, William May, joins us. Marriage as the foundation of family life. We'll take a look at some basic categories, how the world is trying to redefine them, and then we'll pick up on a few particular problems of interest to Catholic moral theologians, including in vitro fertilization. So that's coming up on this hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. And we're also looking forward to spending time with Elizabeth Ficicelli, journalist, author of many books, including Lourdes, Font of Faith, Hope, and Charity. So all that's coming up on today's Cresta in the Afternoon. But first, we hit the headlines with Nick Tom.
Thank you very much, Al, and a good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. It is Thursday, January 7th. The saint of the day is Saint Raymond of Peñafort. Today's news is brought to you in part by Ascension Press. As many as one in five former Guantanamo Bay detainees are suspected or confirmed to have engaged in terrorist activities after their release. That's one in five. This information, according to a new Pentagon report, this is just one of the various complications that President Obama is facing in trying to close the facility. Mima Ram reports from Washington.
This Pentagon assessment, conducted last April, showed that 14% of former detainees had joined or were suspected of joining terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda. Two officials, who spoke on conditions of anonymity, said the new Pentagon assessment showed that the percentage had grown significantly. The disclosure comes amid revelations that former Guantanamo detainees are working for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. The Yemen-based group is thought to be responsible for a failed plot to blow up a U.S. airliner on Christmas Day. President Obama had initially promised to close the detention facility within a year of taking office, but has now acknowledged that he will not be able to meet the self-imposed deadline. Mima Ram, Washington.
Healthcare was on the agenda for House Democrats today. Democrats are trying to figure out how to merge two health insurance reform bills that have been passed by the Senate and House. After a White House meeting yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Democrats are close to an agreement, but warned some difficult challenges remain. The House and Senate health care bills contain significant differences. The House measure does include a government-run public option to compete with the health insurance companies, and the Senate bill does not. A federal judge ruled yesterday that television cameras will not be used to cover the upcoming courtroom debate that will challenge Proposition 8, California's initiative against gay so-called marriage, but the proceedings will be videoed and played on YouTube later. Last week, Judge Vaughn Walker revised a court rule and directed the start of next Monday's trial to be broadcast. Prop 8 supporters protested the idea of broadcasting the trial. After the November election, supporters received hate and threat mail, also some physical violence, and a number of churches became the targets of protest. Backers of Prop 8 said they feared a broadcast trial would lead to further harassment. And the latest and most innovative electronics are being debuted this week at the yearly Consumers Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Although some of the electronics have not yet made it to shelves, other devices are available now. Tech expert Kat Schwartz from eBay talks about Lenovo's latest IdeaPad, one of the gadgets high on her list of must-haves this year, and what it can do.
Swivels all the way around and then folds over to turn into a tablet. So not only is it a laptop anymore, but it's a tablet and it's touch screen.
Some of the devices shown at the CES may never make it to stores. The show is not open to public, but does attract thousands of gadget gurus every year. And now your fascinating fact for the day. Crickets hear through their knees. Reporting for Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Long have the U.S. bishops wanted to see comprehensive immigration reform, and they are now launching a campaign for 2010 to push for new legislation. And with me right now is Kevin Appleby, Director of the Office of Migration and Refugee Policy at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Kevin, thanks for joining me once again.
Thanks for having me again, Al.
I'm a little bit surprised after all the the intensity of the health care reform bill that the bishops want to pick up on another new piece of legislation. I know this is part of the overall agenda, but I'm just surprised how quickly they're getting on board here.
Well, that's a good question, and part of the reason is that we have indications that immigration could well be considered this year in Congress. And you may recall last time in 2007 when the bill died, that one of the main reasons that pro-immigration reform forces lost is because opponents of immigration reform did a better job in ratcheting up support across the country against the bill. So we're trying to avoid that from happening this time, where hopefully we can get Catholics to weigh in with their legislators and then sort of counter some of the, as we will know, the opposition that's going to come.
Yeah. Well, I think the two things that come up over and over again among people who, you know, of goodwill would be, number one, how is this going to handle illegal immigration? And two, is this going to be unfair to people who have been waiting in line to be legally received into this country?
Good questions and often asked. First of all, no one who's been here out of status would be in front of anyone in the line who's there legally waiting for a visa. What would happen is there would be a process where those who are undocumented would have to pay a penalty, pay a fine, pay their back taxes, learn English, and work for several years before they are allowed to get in the back of the line. So, and in the meantime, what the U.S. government would do is clear up those backlogs for those who are in line, who applied through the process, so that they're taken care of. and then bring the others out of the shadows, have them pay a penalty, which they should do, mm-hmm. and then eventually get in line. So sure. so those wouldn't hurt those who have played by the rules in the past.
Okay. I'm curious. Do you have any idea why the government has permitted this backlog?
Well, several reasons. It's resources, number one. It's part of the structure. They have caps on different countries that only certain numbers that they'll do a year. So that's why we're trying to advocate for reform, especially in the family categories where there are years and years of backlogs, where we sort of try to remove some of those caps and put some folks in different categories so that at a minimum, the core family, the brothers, and I mean the spouses and the children, do get in a timely manner, and that's part of what our reform does.
What are some of the other aspects of the reform that the bishops are calling for?
Well, there are several issues in immigration reform. All of them seem to be hot button, but the ones that we would like to see, as I mentioned. The legalization program, a family-based immigration reform. Another controversial issue is whether we should create legal avenues for low-income, low-skilled workers to come and work. Right now, what we have is a system where we've got a huge guest worker program, and it's called people coming across the border illegally or other ways. And what we would propose, and what many labor unions might propose, is let's put a structure on that. Let's get some visas to these people so they can come in through ports of entry. We know who's coming. We can control the flow, and it would minimize the number of people coming across the border, allowing law enforcement, frankly, to look at other threats.
Yeah.
That you know, and a lot of people come across the border. They're not threats. They just want to support their families. So. That's another piece. And then one thing that's unique to the church is that we want a long-term solution that looks at why people come in the first place. What can we do to allow them to have jobs where they are? I'm not saying necessarily that we should give them more foreign aid, but let's at least look at our economic agreements and see that we don't harm the situation. We don't take out the market for low-skilled workers in sending countries so that they can they want to stay where they are. They don't want to go across the desert the way they do. Ideally, they'd like to support their families where they are.
Right.
So let's
right.
try to create conditions that allow for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of cooperation are we apt to get from the government of Mexico?
Well, you know, a lot of it depends on how much leverage we put on them. I think they have tried to make steps in the recent administration to pay attention to their low-skilled workers and their underclass. But I think they do need to do more than they're already doing. But, frankly, we're the largest economic superpower not only in this hemisphere but in the world. So
mm-hmm.
we would have to have some influence on that so that they do implement a broad strategy of creating these jobs for low-income, low-skilled workers in their countries. The church's answer to the border fence is really economic development. And I know that's something that sounds like pie in the sky to a lot of people, and I can understand that. But it really is the most humane solution over time, so that migration is driven by choice and not necessity. And, you know, frankly, this phenomenon occurs throughout the world, as you well know. It's not just a U.S.-Mexico or U.S.-Central
right.
America
right.
problem. It happens everywhere.
The bishops are instructing the faithful in responsibilities, how to be faithful citizens. Why is immigration an important issue? Theologically speaking, biblically speaking, why is this a priority?
Well, theologically speaking, the teaching of the church indicates that, you know, Christ himself was a migrant. He was a refugee fleeing the terror of Herod. He was an itinerant preacher with no place to lay his head. So the theology of the church says that we should try to be open to welcoming newcomers into our communities. Now, that doesn't mean that we should give carte blanche to allow folks to come in outside the structures of the rule of law. And we've never said that they should be forgiven. We've already said that they should pay a penalty, mm-hmm. certainly, mm-hmm. Coming in. And the church has always taught that the sovereign has the right to control its borders. We'd like to see it done in a humane way, but the way that the world is, we support the rights,
sure.
To control our borders. So, but we should be open to newcomers. We should try to understand their plight, get to know them personally. Catholics may still disagree with what the bishops are saying, but I think what the bishops would want Catholics to do is at least look into what the reality is and what the facts are of
right.
the. And if they're not moved, so be it. Hopefully they'll be moved to say, yeah, the system is broken. You know, it's the system that's the problem. We need these workers in certain categories. Certainly when we become a flush economy again, we're going to need them. We shouldn't exploit them in the meantime. You know, we should, if we're going to have them work, then we should give them full rights in the community. And that's sort of where the moral issue stands for the bishops.
Has this been on the list for the president or for the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, really. You know, candidate Obama promised to take it up in his first year of office. That's been delayed some. We know that legislation was just introduced in the House by Representative Luis Gutierrez on this issue. We anticipate legislation to be introduced in the Senate shortly, sometime after the health care debate's over,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a possibility that they could start moving the bill. And the president has indicated that he supports going forward. So we're really just preparing for that. We want to be prepared for the debate, and we know it's going to be a tough one.
Yeah,
as it always is. It's an emotional issue.
If it resembles last time.
yeah, it's an emotional issue, and there are strong feelings on both sides and valid concerns on both sides. So it's just a matter of getting into it and trying to find the right solution.
Now, is there a model bill out there, or do the bishops do that kind of thing?
Well. Well, we do. We try to influence that the model bill be out there. As I mentioned, there was a bill introduced by Representative Gutierrez recently. If folks Googled it, they would be able to get it. I don't have the bill number right in front of me because it was just introduced recently. So,
is that a bill the bishops do support?
We do. We support it, yes. We support it as an important first step in the process.
Okay.
We anticipate there'll probably be another vehicle in the House other than this bill, but this bill sort of gives a marker to lay down for that. So.
And now the bishops have also called for a postcard campaign. They've put up some websites. Tell us about those.
Right. We're launching a postcard campaign. We've already had, you know, 1.5 million postcards ordered around the country. It's for folks to get involved, sign the postcard in support of immigration reform. So just ask your diocese or parish if they're going to be participating, and we can provide them the postcards.
Okay. And again, there's a Justice for Immigrants website and the National Migration Week website also available. Thanks, Kevin.
The goal of Ave Maria University is to graduate the next generation of Catholic leaders for the new evangelization. Here you can be assured of a truly Catholic education where all of our professors are faithful to the Church. Campus life challenges you to grow in radical holiness and virtue. Here, the Holy Spirit comes alive in the hearts of the faithful. The true heart of Ave Maria is the heart of the Church. Call 877-AVEU-NIV or click www.avemaria.edu. Investing can be stressful, especially during tough economic periods. Ave Maria Mutual Funds offers you the peace of mind associated with professional investment management. Experienced portfolio managers make investment decisions based on sound investment fundamentals and pro-life values. If you're a serious long-term investor, now may be a great time to examine your portfolio and see if the Ave Maria Mutual Funds could help you achieve your goals. To learn more, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA for a free investor kit or visit avemariafunds.com.
Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc., a registered investment advisor established in 1980, serves as an investment advisor. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. To obtain performance through the most recent month-end and a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA or at avemariafunds.com. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
Can you see the tremendous value of connecting to a community of like-minded consumers who desire to do business with you? If so, here's that opportunity. Join our community of business owners and professionals who express strong Christian values. Consumers have an added sense of confidence when they find your business in the Catholic Business Pages. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Catholic Business Pages link. Sign up this week and get 3 months free.
Missed a show? Not sure if it came from Ave Maria Radio? Go to AveMariaRadio.net. A list of shows and hosts are there. And if you find the show you're looking for, you can hear the whole thing again by going through the Ave Maria Radio audio archives. For 2 years, we've recorded nearly every show from Ave Maria Radio. Just click on the audio archives message located at the center of our homepage. Now you even have more reasons to become a radioactive Catholic. By going.
Joining me right now, Dr. William E. May, Senior Research Fellow at the Culture of Life Foundation, Professor Emeritus, Michael J. McGivney, Emeritus Professor of Moral Theology at the John Paul II Institute for Studies on Marriage and Family at Catholic University in Washington, D.C., where he taught from 1991 to 2008. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including Marriage, The Rock on Which the Family is Built. Dr. May is one of the English-speaking world's greatest and most respected moral theologians. And Dr. May, it's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
You see Pope Paul VI as a true prophet. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, by a true prophet, the prophet doesn't mean foreseeing the future so much. He doesn't certainly mean that, but one who really reminds us of who we are, okay, and what God's will is for us, something like that. He speaks in the name of God. That's what a prophet is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the prophets of the Old Testament were. They were people who spoke in the name of God, and that's exactly what I think the Pope was, okay? I think that's what Pope Paul VI was.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you watched the church engage the world on this issue of the unitive and procreative bond in the conjugal act? You've watched the world ignore it. Have you been surprised at the consequences of the world's rejection of the teaching of the church?
No, I really have not been, because this is very fascinating, because in this remarkable apostolic exhortation, Familius Consortio, number 32, John Paul II perceptively said that, okay, and this is very fascinating, that the difference between contraception and recourse to the rhythm of the cycle is much wider and deeper than is commonly realized, that the heart is completely irreconcilable concepts of the human person and of human sexuality. Now, he said that was in 1981. But in 1969, I think it was 1977, that was the 500th anniversary of St. Thomas, 700th anniversary of St. Thomas Aquinas. And it was a big conference in Ripples, Italy. And Germaine Grisez, one of my great colleagues, wrote a marvelous article in there on dealing with the new morality. And he said what he did in that magnificent essay was to show that moral thought, moral theology, is rooted in a proper understanding of the human person, human anthropology. And that's exactly what John Paul II was getting at. And he pointed out that he even takes up then the dissenting views of the majority report, one of the majority reports, you know, the papal commission that was
issued
in the, okay? And he shows that underlying that particular report was an understanding of the human person that divorces the person, makes the person one thing and his body another. In other words, it's a dualistic understanding of the human person, The person is, let's say, the conscious subject aware of himself as a self, And the body is part of that subhuman world of nature over which the person has been given dominion. That's what the body is, see?
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what you have at the culture of death. That's exactly what we have today, because many people recognize, in fact, these descending theologians recognize that, because not only did they descend from Humani Vitae, but they also descended from the church's teaching on any moral axis, including those against abortion, right? Because the unborn child, although it's a bodily alive, though it has a human body, this body is not something personal, because the person is the conscious subject, aware of itself as a self, and unborn babies aren't conscious of themselves. You get my point? Understand
yes.
that?
Yes, yes.
That was said by Germaine Grisé back in 1977, but he goes back and he traces it. He makes a marvelous, brilliant analysis and critique of that majority report, which was proposed in 1966, was sent to the Pope,
mm-hmm.
and was released to the public in 1977 to embarrass the Pope and so forth before the encyclical came out. But it's precisely that anthropology that's rooted, that's at the heart of the culture of death. In fact, that's exactly what John Paul II then said in his great encyclical of Evangelium Vitae in 1995. He says that at the heart of this culture of death is an anthropology like this, you know, that divorces the person from his or her body, something like that, an ancient Manichaeanism.
Given that we've had a few generations now where people have emphasized doing a theology from below rather than a theology from above, why haven't professional Catholic theologians taken up more interest in this theological anthropology?
Well, you know, an awful lot of them have.
Okay.
But they take up the pseudo-anthropology. For example, Charlie Kern came out with a book in 2006 called The Moral Theology of John Paul II. Okay?
Right? Okay. Yeah.
Published by Georgetown University Press. Now, that particular book, he repeats the same things he said back in 1968-69, all through the 70s and so forth, accusing John Paul II of physicalism, et cetera, all that kind of nonsense, you know?
Yes.
But the trouble is he never reads his critics. He has been criticized by many theologians, including myself. I mean, I can count the number of theologians who have written brilliant articles tearing his stuff apart, okay? Showing how stupid it is. But he pays no attention whatsoever to the criticisms that he has received. He just ignores those criticisms.
He shows no awareness of them.
Yeah. He shows no awareness of them. He doesn't even take them up or try to rebut them.
Yeah.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable. The same thing happened. For example, there was a woman named Margaret Farley, who teaches. She's a Sister of Mercy She teaches at Yale University. Okay, she's been there for many, many years. Okay, and she receives all kinds of awards from Catholic, you know, scholarly societies such as, I call it, the Corrupt Theological Society of America. It's called the CTSA, the Catholic Theological Society of America. She's received medals from them. She had a book came out in 2008, I believe it came out, called Just Love, in which she repudiates every teaching that the church has ever made in sexual morality. She thinks it's okay to masturbate. She thinks that homosexual activity is fine, and all this kind of stuff. And she ignores completely any criticism that are given of her. And these people still have control of a lot of your Catholic colleges and universities.
Right.
That's the problem here. That's one of our problems. Okay? There's been a movement now. Some of the schools are trying to reclaim their Catholic identity and so forth. But you still have all of these so-called Catholic colleges who dissent liberally from whatever the church teaches. In other words, when I was teaching at Catholic University, the theological students, they first had Charlie Kern before they had me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they had, at that time, that was during the 1970s and early 80s, they had what I would call the hermeneutical suspicion.
Right.
If the church teaches something, it's probably false. That was their opinion.
Yep.
And I thought my duty was, I got them a year after they had this stuff, and I said, my duty, I think, is to show you that perhaps you're wrong and that maybe what the church teaches is true and that you should consider that, you know? But by 1985, the situation was changing. It was beginning to change. And I'd say the seminarians today, they're much, much better. They've cleaned up the seminaries to a great extent. They're really doing a pretty good job, I think, in starting to clean up the seminaries. I hope they can get the universities cleaned up, you know, but they're having a harder time. But at least the seminaries are getting much better, I think. And the students, but I noticed this, the students that were coming in were much more open to the teaching of Humani Vitae and of John Paul II, and with Paul Benedict than they would be to Charlie Curran and Margaret Farley, okay? So that's a good sign.
With people like Curran and Farley, is it a matter of indifference what we actually do with our bodies?
First of all, for them, of course, the body is part of that subhuman world of nature,
yeah,
over which the person has been given dominion, okay? And see, it goes back, as a matter of fact, John Paul II, in his great encyclical on moral life, Veritatis Splendor, takes up their charge. He explicitly addresses their complaints that his teaching is biological. So that's what they claim. It's a lot of bologna sausage, okay? And he shows that their own position is rooted in, and it reminds him of an ancient heritage, namely Manichaeanism. It's a sort of a resurgence of ancient Manichaean philosophy. That's what it actually is. Okay, I'd say that the Manichaeans were the first Planned Parenthood society. You could have sex as long as it was okay for pleasure, but by God, don't get pregnant. That was their major rule, okay? Mm-hmm. That was their principal rule. It's amazing. It's amazing.
The church's teaching, however, is that the body is part of our identity. It's not just part of nature.
Right. It's not just the church's teaching. Not just the church's teaching, but sound philosophy teaches that as well.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you hit me in the nose, you're not trespassing on my property, okay?
Right.
And if you kick me in my family jewels, that's not trespassing on my property, okay? And if I break my arm, I haven't broken my instrument. I hurt myself, haven't I?
Yes, yes.
And even these dissenting people would recognize that. That's common sense stuff. They would recognize that, but they don't want to acknowledge it theoretically, okay? That's the problem.
Yeah.
There's a brilliant book, by the way, Robert George,
yes,
and Patrick Lee came out with a brilliant book. Oh, this is a fantastic book. It came out last year, I guess 2009. Came out, maybe it was 2008, but 2009. It was called Body-Soul Dualism, and Ethics and Public Policy, something like that. And it is a great book. It tears these guys apart from a philosophical point of view.
Yes.
It's a philosophical work. It's a great philosophical study.
I'll have to make sure I get my hands on it. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Let me see. I hope I have the right title for that. I think I have the right title for that. But Robert George and Patrick Lee, you can look it up under Amazon.com.
Sure.
I think that was – I don't have it right. I'm looking on my bookshelf. I think I took it away. I don't have it here at the office. I don't have it here, unfortunately. But I did a review of it. I did a long review of the darn thing. But I don't have it here. But I think it's called Body-Soul Dualism and Contemporary Politics and Ethics. That's it, Contemporary Politics and Ethics, something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the family.
It was published by Doubleday, a very good publisher, you know, very
good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The family, we often talk about the family as the foundation for society. What is the Christian vision for the family? It's not just a building block for society. I mean, it has its
more
own integrity.
Yeah, obviously, more than that, it has its own integrity.
Yeah.
Obviously, it is a central cell. In other words, he says that John Paul II, his theme song there was the future of humanity passes through the family, okay? It passes through the family, and the family is rooted in marriage, okay? But the whole thing about the family is that this is now the Christian family, particularly the Christian family. Don't forget there was a great synod that they had on the, his apostolic exhortation, the Noyes Consortium. That had to do with the mission and role of the Christian family in the church and world today, right? And it has a unique role to play in the church because the family, the Christian family, is a domestic church. It participates, it has a unique participation in the prophetic, priestly, and kingly role of Christ, right? It has this particular thing. And also it has a mission to play, let's say, in forming a community of persons and serving life and in ministry and in acting in its unique capacity within the church itself, okay? So it has a unique ecclesial role, you might say.
So it serves life, it participates in the development of society, is there for the formation of persons,
mm-hmm,
and it shares in the life and mission of the church.
Right, it's the serving life and mission of the church. That's
yeah.
the whole thing here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's remarkable. That's really quite something. And of course, that's developed to a great extent. I take up some of those questions in the book itself. You know, quite a bit of us take it up in there. I take it up quite a bit. For example, in the chapter that had a Christian family, a domestic church,
yes.
chapter 5 in the book and so mm-hmm. forth. And it's taken up too, very, very much so in his letters to families. I have that in the appendix, which is a very good thing. It just sort of summarizes what he teaches in John Paul II, the letter to the families. And they both said, Pope Benedict has a somewhat different approach than did St. John Paul II, but they're in perfect agreement and so forth and so on. Yeah, they really are.
Mm-hmm. Now, what? How would you distinguish their approaches?
Well, I'd say that John Paul II was more of a philosopher. He was really, although he had a degree in theology, he taught philosophy. He was more of a philosopher than a theologian, I would say. Okay.
Okay.
Whereas Ratzinger is much more a theologian. He's been trained as a theologian, you know, from the very beginning, and he's a tremendous theologian. And he's a much better, I mean, he's extremely interested, too, in Scripture, and he does a great job. For example, the book that he did on Jesus of Nazareth, it's going to come out, the second volume coming out pretty soon.
Good.
He's done great stuff on Scripture, much more Scripture studies. Not that John Paul was not dumb. John Paul knew his Scripture quite well.
Sure.
And he followed, you know, used modern critique and so forth and so on. But Ratzinger is what you would call a true biblical theologian. I mean, he really is a biblical theologian, and he approaches it more from that perspective, and also he's more interested in contemporary, what he would call contemporary relativism, which I would identify with John Paul II, identify as proportionalism and consequentialism, and this dualistic understanding of the human person. Of course, he has the same thing. He has a holistic understanding, not a dualistic understanding, but his is more this sort of a cultural relativism. That's his big bêtoir, you might say, okay? Mm-hmm. A bêtoir for Benedict. As far as I can see. Mm-hmm.
How do we believe that the male, man and woman are both persons, that they are embodied persons?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But what defines the difference between male and female?
Ah, that's a great one. You know, that's a terrific question there, but I think that John Paul II takes that up beautifully in his theology of the body, when he maintains that the man's body is assigned to the male, of a gift the male person to the female, and vice versa, and that they, I think, they give and receive each other, right? They give and receive each other. But they do that, I think, in an asymmetrical fashion. You might say that in marriage, the man gives himself to the woman, and she gives herself to him, and together they give themselves to each other, right? They do that.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing, they also receive each other. They receive each other. They give and they receive. They give and they receive. And I think that the man is so structured that he gives in a receiving way, while the woman receives in a giving way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You get the point? That was developed. It's developed in a few of the theology of the body things. In fact, I take that up in one of the, I have a chapter on the theology of the body. I try to point that out. But it's also developed magnificently by Robert Joyce and his book called The Sexual Ecology. Sexual Ecology, toward a philosophy of man and woman.
Hmm.
And he says that the man gives in a receiving way. Take it this way. You have a, usually the man holds the woman's hand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or he is so constructed that he can personally enter into her body. You know, he's so, his anatomy is such.
Dr. May, thank you so much. Looking forward to pursuing this further.
Missed a show? Not sure if it came from Ave Maria Radio? Go to AveMariaRadio.net. A list of shows and hosts are there. And if you find the show you're looking for, you can hear the whole thing again by going through the Ave Maria Radio audio archives. For 2 years, we've recorded nearly every show from Ave Maria Radio. Just click on the audio archives message located at the center of our homepage. Now you even have more reasons to become a radioactive Catholic by going to AveMariaRadio.net.
In 2009, the Put Out of the Deep Men's Conference was held in three parts in three archdioceses of Detroit parishes. On Sunday, January 10th, we complete our coverage of these teachings on the Church of Sacraments. Sacred Heart Major Seminary's Father Dan Trapp teaches on the anointing of the sick, and Father Ben Lutke teaches on confession.
And we need to encounter this Christ that frees us so that we can live, we can love, and we can grow as men of faith. You know, I'll tell you something. It takes guts to be Catholic in this world. It really does. And sometimes it even takes guts to go to confession.
Join us this Sunday afternoon at 2:30 for the third Put Out of the Deep mini-conference on the sacraments of the Church with Father Ben Lutke, Father Dan Trapp, and Deacon Steve Mitchell. Listen to your Catholic conference collection this Sunday afternoon at 2:30 on 990 WDEL, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Richard is a Tell-A-Friend volunteer. Recently he wrote, I went to the hospital to donate blood and struck up a conversation with a man waiting in line. It turns out he's a fallen away Catholic. We talked for 45 minutes. He left with my business card and Ave Maria Radio's call numbers written on the back. I told my wife, God is up to something. Is God up to something in your life too? You can be a Tell-A-Friend volunteer just like Richard. To learn more, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click the Tell-A-Friend button. Join the team. Tell a friend about Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Al Cresta. Today is the anniversary of the birth of St. Bernadette Subaru, whose visions of the Blessed Virgin led to the establishment of the Shrine of the Lourdes. And joining me right now to talk about Bernadette is Elizabeth Ficicelli, author of many books, including The Imitation of Christ for Children and more recently Lourdes, Font of Faith, Hope, and Charity. And Elizabeth, thanks for coming back.
How are you doing on this snowy January evening?
Oh, I'm doing fine, but you're right. It is very snowy weather out there in Michigan where we're broadcasting from. Now, where are you?
We're in Columbus, Ohio, and
yeah.
Our storm's about, about 3 to 5 inches they're predicting, which to me is not really much of a storm. I'm from Long Island, so I'm used to that lake effect that you get from the Atlantic Ocean on one side, the Long Island Sound on the other, and we used to always get a good dumping.
Yes. Now, were you on the? What side of the island were you on?
I was more on the North Shore.
Okay. I lived in New Haven, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I went to school in Bridgeport.
We used to have a look across Long Island Sound and see.
Mm-hmm.
See the island out there.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about St. Bernadette and give me a sense of her personality as a girl.
Well, I think that's a great question and a fair question to ask on her birthday, which before I got on the phone with you, I was figuring out she would have been 166 years old today.
Okay.
But the thing I love to talk about Bernadette is the virtues and the character of her, because that's really what earned her sainthood.
Yes.
You know, people can tend to think that, well, it was because she had these visions of the lady in the grotto 18 times, or because her body was incorrupt when they exhumed it. But no, none of that. I mean, those are wonderful graces, obviously, and gifts from God. But Bernadette was canonized because she demonstrated tremendous virtue. And it starts at her very young age. She was born sickly. She had a life of suffering from the beginning.
Hmm.
She had asthma. They think she may have contracted TB when she was young, which is eventually what she would die from as a young adult. But, you know, all her life she's dealing with this physical suffering. And then on top of that, and I don't know if it's related to her medical conditions, but academically she suffered. You know, she could never seem, as much as she poured her heart into it, she could never master that catechism to earn her first Holy Communion. And and then she suffered from poverty. She was probably the poorest family in the area of Lourdes at the time, and at the time these apparitions are about to happen, she and her family are living in this one-room jail cell, the old jail for the town. So she's in dire poverty, and she suffers all this, adverse conditions, but with a lot of patience and courage. You know, you should begin to see this from a very young age on. And then you also see this young girl having such a burning love for Jesus. All she wants to do is receive him in communion, and it's something we almost take for granted. You know, our kids just go through the process, but for her, it just seemed to be out of her reach. And, you know, she even, when she sent up a couple miles up into the mountains to stay with a family and serve as their nanny, her own family was hoping she would do better up there because it was drier, you know, for her asthma and so forth. She decides to come back to Lourdes because she realizes she's not going to finish her catechism up at Bartres. She comes back to Lourdes willing to suffer again this damp, dark, abode that they're living in, willing to suffer just so she can receive Jesus in the Eucharist. So it's really tremendous. Again, just as she's 14 years old, at this time.
Yeah.
And you see, like, her obedience to Our Lady. At the time it was the Lady. They didn't even know who it was at the time. But she's obedient to this lady she sees in the grotto. she promises her to return 15 times to the grotto. And, you know, after all, that's the only thing Bernadette can offer the lady. She has no money, so she can offer her word and her time. That's all she can give of herself. And she does that freely. And she believes in what the lady tells her, despite ridicule, despite the threat of imprisonment. She just remains faithful to this message that she's receiving. Again, it's, you know, you think about a 14-year-old and the tremendous pressure she was under by police,
mm-hmm.
by the clergy, by the town, by her own family in the beginning.
Well, what were the circumstances that led to the first vision?
The first vision took place on February 11th in 1858, and she was just out with a sister and a friend collecting firewood, which was kind of typical for the winter there. I mean, they had to have fire, you know, to keep them warm, and they could also pick up scraps of cloth or metal or whatever they could find to even sell so they could get some bread to eat. That's how poor they were. And that's when these visions begin to occur, and only to her. But they quickly become very popular, and many people in the town begin to believe that it could be the Virgin Mary. But, of course, it's not till about the 16th apparition when the lady does reveal herself. But, again, you know, with all these people in the surrounding areas, it was such a dangerous time in France, because you have the rise of secularism and enlightenment. And so it's dangerous times to be out there proclaiming Christianity in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church was being persecuted in big ways. So she had such bravery to go out and proclaim what she was hearing, and not doing it in a sense that she wanted to be the center and the limelight and look at me. It was because she was obedient to the lady.
At what point did she assume, anyways, that this was the Blessed Mother?
She did not make the assumption until she was given the name, I Am the Immaculate Conception. And at the time, she doesn't even know what those words mean, because here's a girl who hasn't even studied her catechism.
Yeah.
She has no idea. And plus, it was a new term back
yes.
then. It was only 4 years old theologically, so the backwoods of France would not have known this term. A peasant child would not have known this term.
Mm-hmm.
But this is when it, of course, convinces the clergy that, wow, this could be something serious. This may really be the Virgin Mary appearing here. We need to look into this more seriously. So that's when she's told by the townspeople, do you know who you're seeing? This is the Virgin Mary, you know. And she's pretty overwhelmed by that, because, again, she's thinking, well, why me? You know, I have no wealth. I have no prestige. I have no power. I have no education. Why me? But, of course, isn't that how God works? You know, he chooses the unlikely people. He chooses the unlikely settings of a grotto, you know, a place where people used to take their pigs and water them, you know, that kind of thing. And he just creates the extraordinary.
How large was her family?
She was the oldest of four children. They had some that didn't survive, but there were four surviving.
Mm-hmm.
So she was the oldest. And she took care of her children. And even that's another virtue I see in her. When she goes through all this humility of doing whatever the lady says, crawling in the mud, washing her face in this muddy water. She does all these acts of penance. She takes on this serious mission to pray and do what she can for the sins of the world, including embracing her own poverty. But as she goes into the religious life, this is when all the apparitions are over, and she realizes now her job is done there. Then she puts this total effort on her own self-sanctity and her own journey to holiness. And even in the convent, she stays in contact with these siblings, and they didn't exactly follow the same route she did. You know, one of them ended up selling souvenirs at the grotto, you know, when the apparitions were approved and the shrine was being built. And, so she was admonishing them and being like a little mother to them, even from the convent. It was a role she really took seriously.
My guest is Elizabeth Ficicelli, author of Lourdes, Font of Faith, Hope, and Charity, on this birth anniversary of St. Bernadette. What did she ever write on the meaning of the events for her?
She didn't write anything theological about the events. What she did do was tell people the same story, whether she was asked by townspeople as the young child or even these visiting bishops and royalty who'd come to the convent. It's supposed to be a cloistered convent, and yet this steady stream of visitors would come, and she would tell the story over and over and over again. She actually does write a written account of it, and it was pretty much in the early years. She was actually at the hospice. That's where the priest first put her, to work with the nuns there, kind of get her out of the spotlight. And she does write an account of it. She does have a journal that was published later, you know, some of her letters home and her writings, but she really doesn't spend a tremendous time delving into the theology of these visions. Mm-hmm. They were actually very simple visions in terms of messages.
Yeah.
And it was a call to conversion of heart. It was a call to do penance, you know, for the reparation of sin. Very gospel-oriented, very gospel-related. So it was a simple message, the kind that you don't need to write a lot about, but the kind you need to live out.
Yes, yes. Did she know this? That it would become a healing shrine?
She was not told by the lady when she was instructed to dig for this spring that did not seem to exist. She was not told by the lady because this is going to be a healing place. This is going to be a healing shrine. She was given no message to do that. She was just simply told to uncover the spring, to wash her face in the spring. And so, of course, that's when she's digging in the mud, and the people observing don't see any spring either. All they're seeing is this girl covering her face and her body with mud. And so they're, you know, many of them are quite scandalized by it.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, these healings begin to take place immediately, you know, just days after the spring is uncovered, you know, healings start happening at a pretty rapid pace. And this, of course, will be one of the great blessings of the shrine at Lourdes. It is a place that people continue to go to, continue to wash their face, drink the water, and even bathe in these waters, just as Bernadette had done. And there are healings, physical, spiritual, and emotional healings.
How did the church respond?
The church actually, when you look at the history, responded very quickly. These apparitions were approved about 4 years after they took place. And
wow.
I think that's lightning speed for the church.
Yeah, that's true.
But again, I think the reason is the messages were simple and straightforward, but the big reason I think they approved these apparitions was because of Bernadette. She was such an exemplary model of a visionary. Just true to her story, not seeking that attention, not making the story more than it was, just choosing to live a quiet, holy life afterwards, not looking for stardom. And
she exhibited virtues early on. And
heroic virtues.
Yeah. Well, a likely candidate for future sainthood.
Right. And so it was, all of those things fit together. You know, that's what they look at with these different reports of apparitions. They're looking at the messages. They're looking at the message bearer. They're looking at the fruits of the messages. And when they put all of that together regarding Lourdes, it was, I guess, a pretty easy sell. Because, like I said, those apparitions were approved 4 years after they happened, after they were concluded. So that's very fast.
What has your experience been like at Lourdes?
Well, I was sent over there in 2005, went over there with my husband, and for the purpose of writing a book to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the apparitions. That was 2008 was the anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating. I'd never been there before, so I wanted to go as a pilgrim on one hand, but then as this investigative journalist on the other.
Mm-hmm.
I was given a great opportunity to have all these interviews set up for me with people like the bishop and the medical director and the rector and these chaplains and heads of volunteer organizations, and you know, really to get a good inside story so that I could present Lourdes looking at, you know, the past, where it is today, and where it's headed for the future. And you know, we know both Pope John Paul and Pope Benedict have visited Lourdes, and so it's just really one of the most important Catholic shrines.
Is its popularity increasing?
Increasing, yeah. 6 million pilgrims a year, and the number is growing. You know, and it's not only Catholics who go there.
No, that's right.
Since I've gone there, just people seeking.
Yeah, men and women of goodwill seeking
Absolutely.
God. Yeah. Elizabeth, thanks once again. Appreciate your work. Stay in touch, huh?
I sure will, Al. You have a happy new year.
And to you. Elizabeth Ficicelli, Lourdes, font of faith, hope, and charity, with a foreword by our friend Father Benedict Groeschel. I'm Al Cresta.
Now on DVD, unlock the mystery of the world's most famous star.
As I came across an article by a PhD astronomer that took the position the star was a real astronomical event. Whether they believe in God or not, they're going to show you this shot.
Compelling scientific theory that the Star of Bethlehem existed from a cynic's point of view.
That's what John saw. Can a star stop?
How can a star stop?
From the Passion of the Christ producer Stephen McAveety, the Star of Bethlehem.
Because if we found the star and a reasonable person could conclude that we have, well, then the star was part of the natural order.
BethlehemStar.net to see with your own eyes as the Magi did.
The goal of Ave Maria University is to graduate the next generation of Catholic leaders for the new evangelization. Here you can be assured of a truly Catholic education where all of our professors are faithful to the Church. Campus life challenges you to grow in radical holiness and virtue. Here, the Holy Spirit comes alive in the hearts of the faithful. The true heart of Ave Maria is the heart of the Church. Call 877-AVEU-NIV or click www.avemaria.edu.
Capernaum, Calvary, the Mount of Beatitudes, the Mount of Transfiguration, Bethlehem, and Nazareth. Hi, this is Teresa Tomeo, host of Catholic Connection, and those are just a few of the beautiful holy sites and holy cities you'll visit when you join me and author, speaker, and certified guide Steve Ray on our next pilgrimage to the Holy Land, June 3rd through the 13th of 2010. And your trip includes round-trip airfare from New York, three nights hotel along the Sea of Galilee, and five nights in Jerusalem. Plus, daily mass, daily talks and teachings for both Steve and myself, and of course, great food, fellowship, and an awful lot of fun. It's a life-changing and faith-growing experience. So join us, won't you, in the Holy Land next year, Steve Ray and myself, June 3rd through the 13th. Reservations may be obtained at Corporate Travel, 313-565-8888. Or for more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net at the Holy Land link.
Well, thank you once again for being here. Follow up. We really scratched the surface on so many different topics you need to pursue. And head on over to AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the Crested Guest Archives, follow up on the websites, the books that are mentioned, go to the online bookstore, head on over to the blog, crestinTheAfternoon.blogspot.com. And also, you can re-listen. We've got the podcast all available. So I'll look forward to being with you, Lord willing, tomorrow for another edition of this thing we call Crested in the Afternoon. And again, let me urge you to keep us in your prayers as we go about digging into this new year. Thanks so much.
Cresta in the Afternoon is produced and distributed by Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The executive producer is Nick Tom. The technical engineers are Kara Coulter and Anne-Marie Parisot. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
What makes the miracles of Jesus even more miraculous? Standing where they happened, in Israel. Come visit Cana, where Jesus transformed water into wine. Sail the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus walked on the water. Celebrate the Holy Eucharist throughout the land where Jesus lived. To learn more about standing where it all happened, in Israel, the Holy Land, visit GoIsrael.com. Come visit Israel. You'll never be the same.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I am Father Thomas Loya, and this week on Light of the East on Ave Maria, we will look at feast days in the church calendar that show unity in diversity.
But also some issues that still divide the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church.
Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday mornings at 7 on 990 WDEO.
Wouldn't you like your business to be recognized among Catholics in the community as a business of integrity, trust, and moral character? The Catholic Business Pages offers you that opportunity. The Catholic Business Pages, business professionals held to a higher standard. Is your business qualified? Sign up now and get 3 months free. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Catholic Business Pages link. Get connected.
You're listening to Ave Maria.